a huge pleasure to be here. It is actually my Cork debut, unless you count the 2 minutes that I did at the launch of the Brooklyn Nagian Times, if anybody remembers that publication, in the mid-90s, Giovanni Melito, rest him, edited it, and he had a launch down in Cork, and I drove down for my 2 minutes of fame. So it's fantastic to be here, to read for slightly longer. I'm checking my watch now, because I never remember to. I had thought I'd read this poem first, but I want to check, did anybody watch the match on Saturday?
Yeah.
Well, then I will do this. It's called Twickenham Twilight. On reading the Poet Laureate's praise poem to Johnny Wilkinson in the Observer Sport Monthly, 6th of March 2004. Come all you brave rugby heads and listen to my song of how those 40 men in green ran riot in Twickenham. It was the sixth day of the month, the sun shone bright and hard, the fans streamed in and took their seats and gazed on Clive Woodward, who urged his white shirts all to leave prawn sandwiches on the plate and put the upstarts to the rack to prove they were first rate. And not just another one-hit troop, but O'Driscoll had a plan that every line-out ball would loop out of the English hand and into O'Kelly's demon grasp, then onto O'Gara's foot, till Gordon Darcy clinched the rout and Dempsey's try raised gasps. And silence reigned at Twickenham, and nothing more was heard, save distant strains of Athenry, and the chariot came in third. I actually sent that, I emailed that to Andy Motion, who was the Poet Laureate then, and he just sent me back one line reply, sure you deserve it. And this is actually, I mean, clearly I'm more rugby obsessed than I thought. This is a poem that I wrote really about what we used to get up to when we were in our 20s in clubs in Dublin. And in those days it was called the Five Nations, not the Six Nations. Tonight she's kitted out with extra care. This highlight of the sporting calendar demands attention to the finer details. Her makeup is flawless too. Cheekbones resurface in a pool of blush, narrow eyes arched with pencil into wide surprise. She meets the others in a coffee bar, espresso's better as it doesn't smear, to talk pack strategy, discuss formation and the game plan, which is elegantly plain, first quarter to identify the prey, send off the opposition by half time, on final whistle, divvy up the spoils. The pub's just down the road. They put their shoulders to its heavy oak and heave into a solid scrum of backs and forwards swarming round the bar. The ball is well in play, but she's dismayed to quickly top the score. There are too many players on this pitch. Regroup outside the door, adjusting outfits mould in the last ruck. But she is not deterred. The night's just started and the season's young. The Triple Crown remains unwon, and possessing club concessions might avert the wooden spoon. She takes a taxi, ignores the driver, then responds with grunts as she replays the evening's highlights in her head. A pass, one fumble of the ball, a perfect set down by the public phone, 3 tries and 1 conversion, and a rematch next time home. That's the last 14-1 for a while. I actually spent a lot of time in Cork when I was a kid. My, you know, not surprisingly, with the name O'Mahony, my father was born in Mitchelstown and grew up in the Commons Road. So my grandmother lived in 107 Commons Road. I don't know if anybody lives on Commons Road here, but anyway, my grandmother did. She died when she was 102 in 1989. So may it not run in the family, that particular gene. I used to go down and visit a lot, and sort of I remember the walk-in from her house, which I gather is now partially a ring road. We used to walk down to Blackpool, past the church and up Ladies Well and into town that way, but I gather that's not physically possible anymore, or maybe it is because it is a ring road where I used to walk. So the first poem that I actually wrote as an adult, as a grown-up trying to write poetry again. I had done a creative writing course in the Gaiety, and the exercise was to go home and write the poem. And I said, I don't know, I'm not a poet. You know, and he said, well, maybe you're not, but you might have to write about a poet sometime soon ago. So I found myself writing this poem about an aunt who, with a sort of spooky coincidence that poetry seems to be full of, had actually died 5 years to the day that I started writing this poem, but I didn't realise at the time that it was her anniversary. And I started writing it, and essentially it wasn't like any other writing I'd done, and I got addicted to poetry, so it started there. It's called The Carer. After, when we'd shaken off the clay, though chill remained to spite the late spring day, I climbed once more the deep and narrow stairs to your room. Perfume proudly displayed unopened, a gift from the niece in London. ABBA records, I never heard you play. Your picture of Padre Pio. And dolls, stiff-backed and glassy-eyed, dressed in costume of countries you never got to see, never expected to. A layer of dust, the only sign of absence. Personal effects laid out under the gaze of mourners. My grandmother, as I said, lived to an incredible age. She was the most determined woman, and I don't know if you know those houses in that part of Commons Road. They're very steep and narrow, with stairs that are practically vertical. And my grandmother refused any suggestion that we'd move her bed down to the ground floor. She was absolutely no question of it. She was going to get up there every night, even though she was utterly sort of crippled and bent over. So an uncle put some hooks up along, and every night the ritual of going to bed, which is this. Bedtime in Commons Road. The last step was the hardest. You would build momentum on the earlier ones, body crouched for the ascent, as if defying gravity by will alone. Metal handles placed above each stair became the irons in this Everest climb. Fingers, purple under flaking parchment, hooked each grip with improbable strength. Legs in crumpled nylon, heels half out of slippers, obeyed your imperative with every lift. The landing plateaued into promised rest, but one last heave was needed. You'd pause, muttered imprecations growing strong, oh God, God help me, now, before the final swing of back and hips brought safety for another night. My father, as I said, is from here, though he spent, you know, he came to Dublin to work in the civil service, so he's been 60 years and more in Dublin, but he still sends Cork when he's on the phone to the relations. You know? This is two little portraits of him. Still life for my father. You doze, sofa sprawled, hands resting on the gentle rise and fall of your paunch. The newspaper open on the racing page defies gravity. Your glasses hang on, arm tucked into the neck of your cardigan. Your face in repose, the lines smoothed out, the Stuart Granger hairline intact, hair still pepper and salt despite your 77 years. Shadows beneath your eyes, the fretwork of blue veins is a family trait. Your open mouth, a perfect crescent moon upturned. And in that instant, it's my heart that stops. And this is, he's a betting man. And when I was in the UK for about 4 years, first of all in Norwich, and then I was in Wales, and when he came to visit, his first sort of reconnaissance was where the nearest betting shop was. So in Norwich, there's a Ladbrokes in Dove Street, so if ever you happen to be in need of a betting shop, there's one in Dove Street. This poem is called Love Tokens. Sorry, I said there'd be no more sports. They are rectangular slips, flimsy with a week's wear. Your handwriting clear, that familiar neatness, the rounded D I trace as a child when trying to imitate your D-O-M. Names of winners and losers, starting prices, recalling summer afternoons with Bruff Scott and form books. In the outbreaks, I draw horses frozen in grotesque shapes over Beecher's Brook, while under breath I'd recite a litany, Arkle and Pat Taff, Midnight Court, The Minstrel, Mill Reef, Red Rum. On Sundays, Saturdays, I'd give you back your chair. As you watched each race, I'd watch you rocking on your invisible saddle, momentum building with every length, tension coiled, waiting to spring with joy or a let me pink torn slip. Much like the ones I'm holding now, but not as keepsakes. My father's daughter, I'll retrace your steps to Dove Street and redeem them, knowing the girl at the desk will top them up and never guess their value. The middle part of this is on the back, I family, I guess, features a lot in my work. I wanted to try and tell my maternal grandparents' Civil War love story in poetry. Sure, why not? That's them on the back of this. And basically, the story goes that this is in Kitimat, County Mayo. My grandmother was stepping out with a guy who got held up because he'd shot dead two brothers in a brawl in a pub in Kitimat. And he goes on the run to America, and she's interrogated by my grandfather, who turns out to be my grandfather. So I sort of tell the story around that. So that this is just one poem from that. It's called Portrait, Dublin, 15th of November, 1919. Sean said it would be a grand joke to pretend we were on honeymoon. Could he do it right? All the trimmings, lunch at Wynn's, a stroll through the green. We can get our portrait taken in Richmond Street. He's full of strange notions, that man. So off we went to lunch, and two of the tastiest cutlets I'd ever had. We were fierce elegant with our petit pois on white porcelain. The waiter was a Tracy from Enniscrone. He winked at Sean and kept the wine flowing, so the room tilted when we finally rose and floated all the way to Richmond Street, to a Georgian house with a smudged brass plate that said Green's Photographers. We went inside, eyes adjusting to the dark. The air was heavy with dust and acid smells. Mr. Green was small. He had no time for chat as he showed us where to stand next to a large fern in a copper pot. He took some time arranging us, fiddling with an oriental screen. Then he was ready. Stand, stop still. And we froze. I thought of mother and father, their portraits gilt-framed over the piano, imagining where ours might go one day. Then something flashed, there was a burning smell, and it was light and dark at the same time. Things cleared, Sean paid, and we left, blinking in the glare of Richmond Street. So Sean is the guy who shoots the people there, and they never basically get it together. Thank God, if they had, I wouldn't be here now. So this is a sort of a tourist postcard poem, in three parts. It's called Venice Postcard. One, at the Peggy Guggenheim. Mm-hmm. Riveted by a boy again, equestrian this time, bronze, erection pointing canal words, signposting the end of his pilgrimage through a dilettante's garden. Who wouldn't choose to be buried with their art and 14 shih tzus? Apparently, actually, she had lasso dogs, but that wouldn't scan. So, what to do with poetry, isn't it? School outing. They've come straight from Grafton Street to the Reba. Voices shrill, dodging dames and furs. Rush, fueled by something sneaked between gondola rides and secret tours. Panicking mid the tricorn hats, touching bags, fleeing the carnivale, they clatter on, dropping cameras, a compact button boots. Till they're brought up short, energy corralled by the gatekeeper, who waits for them at the water's edge, foot tapping, lips pursed. Santa Salute chimes the lock-up bell. on the gondola. It might have been romantic if we both brought someone else. So we settled for self-consciousness, admiring Roberto's steel with Roberto's ass. No hand trailing here, but languidness all the same, being propelled through the Calais, hearing the water lap, the plop of plaster crumbling, a rat swimming somewhere. This is the first novel that I published last year. We were talking about narratives and storytelling in the workshop earlier. It's interesting to see how far you can try and push storytelling and poetry and character and plot and all of these things. I had been lucky enough to have been shown a cache of letters which were lodged in the National Library, but they had been written by a woman called Margaret Butler, who emigrated with her 9 brothers and sisters to Australia in the 1850s. And she had, over about a 40-year period after that, she had written home to the cousins in Cleberstown, which was, I think, in the Kilkenny-Waterford border. And there were lots of gaps, lots of hiatuses, but you got this sense of this extraordinary woman who was miserable, really, in Australia. She didn't want to go. She never really settled to the squatter's life, as she called it. But I just got something about that voice resonated. And, you know, I was living in Wales at the time, and I didn't really feel like I was in exile in the same way. Yet, there was something about her experience that I recognized. So I decided that I would make up a narrative around these letters, but sort of imagining what her life must have been like. I also created a contemporary narrator who'd allow me to kind of respond to things that were going on in my own life, but who wasn't me, as I keep on saying to people, Fiona is not me. Far better sex life than I ever had. And then I needed a third voice, so I created Lizzie, who was a workhouse orphan, because they actually shipped women over to Australia in the 1850s, essentially as breeding stock. So they invited people in the workhouses who wanted the opportunity of a new life to go. So my Lizzie went. So this is, I'm going to try and give you a taste of each of them. But I'll give you Fiona first. My first love, since you ask. William Powell in The Thin Man. His wisecracks were the epitome of style. I'd insist my future man must share his wit. No dark masters for me. I scorned my schoolmate's whims for Darcy or Rochester. My grandmother said, for every old sock and old shoe, and I knew there was one to fit. Years passed. I watched my friends pair off, had vodka-fueled chats about what signals I was sending out or wasn't. Then I felt for the first time, if you don't count the boy who fenced and who turned out to be gay, for abusive, beautiful youth, all gangling limbs and joints that cracked, eyes like melted Bourneville. But he wouldn't be untrue to his college sweetheart, and by now I could do platonic pretty well. My specialist subject to be the confidant to a variety of males. Then sex appeared in the guise of a curly-haired satyr who made it look so easy, gave me a taste for Sundays in bed and moonlight dances and doing it on beaches. My mistake was to think it would outlast the novelty. But I was finally launched, could look my friends in the eye, trade stories about male perfidy. The pattern was set, the search and find, the rescue when it all went wrong, as it always did. There was no other way. The happy ones were just fooling themselves. When my father stopped asking, had I met anyone I care for more than myself, I knew my fate was set. Not me. So this is Lizzie. Orphan. Lochray Workhouse, September 1847. I wasn't born here, but don't remember any other home. Ma brought us in one winter. When her stomach got too loud, she died soon after. then it was just me. We live behind high white walls, sleep in cattle stalls. I only left once, tried out a farmer's house where I cooked, scrubbed. They sent me back as I didn't please the mistress. Each day the same, up before cockcrow, we take our straw, dry rub the walls till they shine, then kneel 2 hours in the prayer hall. If God hears, he doesn't let on. We queue for oatmeal and watered milk. We do our shift, sticking shirts, spinning flats. Only the infants and dying have no work. Once the laundry was short, some scraps of cloth. We were taken out one by one and searched. The men watched, low laughs behind hands. Some devil urged me on, and I spoke up, said they had no right to treat us so barbarous. Quick as anything, I was caught, dragged out by the hair. The master pulled at my clothes, left my breast bare. He kicked me, dragged me, put his hands where he shouldn't have, till the girls gathered round, nudging like young calves, closer and closer, so he had to turn, go back to where the men stood laughing. The girls lifted me up, covered me, found a rag to stop the blood, carried me to the corner of the woman's yard. But they came and searched me there, lifting up my skirt, reckoning what I wore. I had but one petticoat. And finally, I'll give you Margaret. And find her. I had a flawless filing system here involving yellow post-it notes with numbers. Not exactly flawless. Margaret. I remember we stood on the old bridge one August night, the air sweet, not a breath between us. I barely felt your hand on my back as we watched the stream ripple the stones. All at once, a dart of blue, a flash of orange skimming over water. A gift, you said, naming it, although I already knew this king of fishermen, the first of many gifts, Forrestal. Forrestal was the cousin who she used to write to. I'm going to finish with just a couple from the what will hopefully be the new book. I didn't want to do that one. I told you this was flawless. Yeah, this is a poem from 1981, actually. After I did my leaving, I was sent to do a typist course, as all good girls should do. And I was in Miss Emerson's Typing Academy in Abbey Street. So this is basically what used to happen here on the first Friday of the month. First Friday at the Academy. Hush after the rush of Abbey Street. The air damp, smelling of old prayers as my feet find the stairs, hands the rail, and I mount to the first landing. Mahogany door, wood chipped, graffiti scarred, glass bubbled and stained, the name a gilt arc, Miss Emerson's Academy for Girls, established 1932, the year of the Eucharistic Congress. Brass knob, finger smeared, resists my push-pull, the whoosh of rubber on tiles, and I'm there, blinking in the half-light of dust, the metal sheen of Remingtons. She stands in the centre, housecoat shiny blue, three-quarters length, leaving an edge of something floral above the wrinkled tan of nylon. A paper hanky is tucked into the copper, cupping her wrist. Purple veins fret the underskin. The stick, half cane, half prop, in one hand, in the other, an open tin of quality stretch. I risk her eyes, their milky blue sheen, and the question, did you receive? The others, seated, fingers poised on keys, wait, chewing contentedly their toffee hosts. I must choose to hold my knuckles out or extend an open palm. The room chimes to a carriage return. Mm-hmm. I possibly should explain to the younger people in the room. People used to go to Mass on the first Friday of the month, and she would bring her students, typing students, to Mass, and if you were good enough and were able to get communion, you'd get the sweetie afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't tell you whether I was or wasn't. I read a couple of poems about my dad earlier. 4 years ago when I was in Wales, he got very seriously ill, and it was one of the reasons that I came back sooner than I was planning. He had a pulmonary embolism, blood clot to the lung, and we spent about 11 days in St. James's waiting room, intensive care waiting room, basically to see whether he'd come around. And it was a very strange experience being in that waiting room. So I wrote a sort of a sequence of three poems. This is number two. The rules for survival. Don't catch an eye on the first day. Look away if their blank grief graces over you. If still hear the next, permit a faint smile, a nod to a fellow traveller. But keep your space. Don't approach unless invited to, and only then with care. Avoid those with a story to tell, a need to eat you alive, as they rave about hands squeezed, the twitch of a closed eye. You can't spare a shred, a prayer, it's dog eat dog here. The odds are too high, if somebody has to die, let the noose loose elsewhere. Those last words there, noose loose, was actually something Dad said when he came around. He said, the noose is loose. Nobody had any idea what he was talking about, but I thought I'd use it in the poem. So this is fourscore. Dad was 80 a couple of years ago. Fourscore for Donal Mahony on his 80th birthday. This past year, you forced us to drop our class acts, take off our masks of career woman, scholar, don the robes of Mary and Martha. If memory serves, there wasn't a third sister in that family, just dual opposites, service and sociability. I blanch at the tasks my sisters fasten upon, one dabbed with this toothbrush amid all those wires and beeping monitors, the other handmaiden of the late night, purveyor of oils and emollients. I can't say that word. Emollients? Don't have a word you can't pronounce in a poem. Emollients that soften your poor feet. I look on, wish myself stronger, kinder. Then you find something only I could do. The daily trip, the ritual script of betting slips, of odds you've already beat, are beating still. And I'll finish with this one. When I came back and I started as a freelancer, I was basically earning more then than I am now, I think. Diary of a Freelancer, 1st of November 2006. What did I earn today? A heron's vigil in the Owen Dower, two magpies suffer posture envy. A woman's tears released by memory. A one-eyed kitten unaware of fearful symmetries. The flattened silhouettes of badger and two rats. A portal dolman nearly found beside the newly built dog pound. The crunch of beech nuts underfoot. A gold pressed miniature work atop a crab apple leaf. The setting sun seducing furs on Montpellier. Oh yes, and €80 all declared. Thank you.